Reasonable. It's the reasonable. It's the reasonable. It's the reasonable. Coming to you every day.
Welcome back to the Reset Rebel podcast with me, Jo Yule. And as the name of this podcast would imply, resetting and rebelling are exactly what our guests are usually booked and their life stories are based upon, their ability to do both. And today, we're just about to receive a masterclass from none other than DJ Fat Tony, a man who's hoovered up more than £1 million worth of drugs, partied in London for decades with the likes of Boy George and so many of our other 80s icons. But Tony has also been clean and sober for 17 years and hosted a podcast series, written a book, I Don't Take Requests, as a testament to his battles to get to where he is now, playing gigs for the likes of Kate Moss, Elton John and the Beckhams, but also fighting for trans rights and for the LGBTQ community, inspiring others to go into recovery. And he recently got engaged. Tony, welcome to the Reset Rebel.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Yeah, recently engaged. It's mad, isn't it? That's recovery. Someone, you know, I'm 58 and I'm getting married. I never thought I'd get married because I could never have been with one person. And now I can be with myself, so therefore I can be with someone else, which is a remarkable thing. And it's testament to recovery.
I mean, I love a love story. Let's start there. I mean, obviously you romantically proposed in front of a fountain in the middle of New York.
Well, not just a fountain, in front of the Freedom Fountain. You know, the fountain in Central Park. Because not a lot of people know it, but the actual angel in the middle of the fountain is an LGBTQI. So the woman that designed it, designed the face of the angel on her girlfriend all those years ago, and no one ever knew until she died that that's what it was based on. So it suddenly become this kind of underground thing about it being, you know, without covering it in rainbow flags. It's just, you know, it's a love story in itself. And I really thought it would be really poignant to get married there, to get engaged there. So I asked him to marry me on that sunny day in October. And then I'm getting married in like a year's time. It's kind of mad.
But you say that's a testament to recovery. And, you know, people always say, oh, well, if you don't love yourself, you can't love anyone else. I mean, is that something you agree with?
Well, of course, that's totally true. You know, I mean, obviously, RuPaul's stolen that at the end of every episode of RuPaul's Drag Race. But that's because he's a 12-stepper. You know, the thing about it is it's so true, because when you go through life loathing yourself or hating yourself and for who you are and what you do, there you don't understand the meaning of, if you can't love yourself and love who you are, you can't love anyone else. You know, I went through life wanting to be liked. I never ever wanted to be loved, because love was intimacy. And I never ever wanted anyone to ever know the real me, because I hated the real me. And then when I wrote my book, and I went through the process of writing that book over 2.5 years, I realized that there was so much stuff that I'd never dealt with, that I'd plowed through life. See, I'm a plower. I go through and it builds up, pushes to one side and I forget about it. I think I've forgotten about it, but I haven't forgotten about anything. But I'm already on to the next drama. So the next drama will always put the plaster on the old drama and anaesthetize the old dramas, because there's always another drama a meter down the road, you know. And now that I'm kind of relatively drama free, and writing that book, it was a massive, massive, massive learning curve, because I had to face all of those demons that I was writing about, and you know, and then to find at the end of it that it was all about wanting to be loved and not wanting to be liked. You know, because I used to love people liking me for being bitchy or being, you know, nasty to them, or just you know, the most funniest person in the room and all that rubbish. But you know, I never wanted anyone ever to get close, because then they would actually find out really what I was like.
So what was it about, you know, the difference between intimacy and you know, allowing someone or willing someone to love you, and the difference between that and just wanting to be liked? How did that kind of birth between you and your partner?
When I met my partner, I met him first of all 12 years ago, and it was on the, at the end of a sex addiction, and he was at uni and he came to meet me, traveled 2.5 hours to meet me, and I was living at that point in time in Hampstead at my friend George's house, who was always away on tour, but you know, i.e. Boy George, and I was living in his house, and the rule was boys weren't allowed to come to the house when George was back. Boy, in fact, boys weren't allowed to come to the house at all, but you know, it was like Sainsbury's in there most days. And so Stabs came to meet me, and George came back unexpectedly, and I met Stabby at the Hampstead tube station. I was like, oh, I'm gutted, you can't come to the house. My flatmate's come back, and he's like, oh, I've travelled 2.5 hours to meet you. And I was like, I know a really good bush on the heath. So off we went to the heath, and we did what we did on the heath, and it was actually bonfire night. So firework night, and so the fireworks were going up. I always say to him, it was in June, and the fireworks were just in your head because it was so magical. And then the next day, I rang him and I said, "Oh, do you want to go on a date?" And he said, "No."
It was that good.
And I called. Of course, no, it was that good. But I automatically, because he got a phone call. No one ever gets a phone call. So it was obviously that good for me to call him the next day and want seconds. Because as a sex addict, you never ever want to know their person's name. You don't want to know their number. You do not want to know anything about them. It's the opposite end of the spectrum to, so when you know it's the opposite end of the spectrum to intimacy. It's so far fetched when people go, "Oh, I like to get intimate with strangers." It's not intimacy. It's sex. And you know, like when people explain to you, "Oh, my husband is a sex addict. She's been having an affair." That's not sex addiction, that's an affair. Because an affair is intimacy. Mm. Sex addiction doesn't allow you to be intimate with anyone, because that's the opposite end of it. Mm. Do you get what I'm saying? So, anyway, getting back to the story. He basically was like, "Oh no, I don't want to go on a date with you." So I was like, "All right, well, fuck you." Anyway, 10 years later, I was just coming out of the worst relationship of my life. The last 3 years of that relationship, my last relationship, I was with someone for 8 years, and it just got really toxic, and it was really awful, and I was going through a really bad time. And then I met Stavi again, and he came into my life in a very different circumstance, and we started seeing each other. Literally, come over to my house. It was like, you know, keep the cab waiting, have sex and fuck off, basically, scenario, which was great, you know, because I didn't want to get into a relationship with anyone after coming out of the tail end of that relationship, because there was so much drama going on. I mean, like, serious drama going on, and I didn't want to include him in it. And so anyway, then it came to the end of lockdown, and I said, "I have to go to Ibiza. Do you want to come with me?" And we hadn't even slept together. We'd had loads of sex, but, you know, we hadn't slept in the same bed. So I didn't know where he snored, if he was messy or any of those things. So it was a real make or break thing. So we ended up in Ibiza at the W, the only people there. It was empty.
Wow.
Yeah, it was great. And I spent the weekend with him, and we've been together ever since.
He doesn't snore then?
No, he doesn't snore. Far from it. And it's just, you know, I've never met anyone like him in my life. Well, I probably have, actually, but I've never allowed them in. And with Stabs, it's a totally different relationship, because we both have very, very big pasts, and we're both aware of our pasts, and we're not ashamed of our past. Mm. And we're not ashamed of who we are today. And I've truly put myself in a place where I'm able to love other people, because I love myself. I'm okay with who I am. I don't wake up anymore hating myself. I don't think, "Oh my God, you're old, you're fat, you're any of those things," because I'm not. And, you know, so I'm probably in one of the most magical places I've ever been in my life.
Wow. I mean, that's...
Say it hand on heart, you know, for me, life right now is a pretty special thing, because I don't take anything for granted. I don't waste my days like I used to. You know, every day is a blessing, and you know, I try to do as much in that day as I possibly can. And if it means rest, it's a rest day. I accept it as a rest day, and you know, because they're very important. You know, to just to get that balance in life, and I'm very balanced at the moment.
I'm so happy to hear these words come out of your mouth. It's a beautiful thing. But let's go back to the beginning when Freddie Mercury gave you your first line of cocaine at 16 years of age at Heaven. I'm fascinated to hear the story, if you will, because obviously he's very closely associated with Ibiza and the time that you spent at Pike. So it'd be quite nice to start with a Freddie tale.
Well, you know, I met Freddie and all his mates out. So I was standing outside Heaven. This is in my book. And, you know, I made a mistake of having a conversation once about it on the Mixmag documentary that kind of restarted a lot of things for me. And in that conversation, I said, oh, Freddie, he said, who gave you your first line? And I was like, actually, it was Freddie Mercury. And, of course, it's one of those like taglines of life. It's like you started this interview with, oh, he spent over £1 million on cocaine. And that was another part of a conversation. It was never a boast. It was never like, oh, this is who I am. It was not a Lamborghini moment.
No.
It was, you know, it was never a badge of honour. And the Freddie story was just one of those nights out, like many stories, but people latch onto it because it's Freddie. And he gave me my first line. I went back to his house with all his mates, and they're passing around the tray, and I was like, no, I don't do drugs. And they were like, you know, go on, try it. You know, it will like sober you up a little bit. So I did it, and I absolutely hated it. So I, of course, ended up staying all night and doing more. And it's really funny. The guy that I did the Mixmag doc with, Seb, he thought every day he would come out with these one-liners at the end to try and get another story. And he was like, so what was Freddie Mercury like in bed? And I was like, I don't know. There were six other people there. So there's your answers to that one.
Did that stop you?
It stopped him from asking any more questions. But you know, the thing about it is, I loved Freddie, and Freddie was a really good person, and he was a very, you know, if he was alive today, he'd be exactly that same person. Do you know what I mean? Because he had a heart of gold. He's like, lots of people that come into my life for a reason. Freddie didn't come into my life to give me a line of cocaine.
No.
It was just a circumstance that night. But, you know, it was, it's a good story.
It is a great story. I'm sorry to have brought up all of the classics that I've heard elsewhere.
No, I'm glad you brought it up. I mean, you know, it's, when I wrote the book, I tried not to do any more of those stories, because what I didn't want was those moments. Because, you know, there's stories in my book where I changed the names on purpose, because if the real name was in there, that suddenly the book would be about that story. Mm. And I didn't want that. You know, for me, it's the stories are important, not the people. And I learned that very early on. It doesn't matter who it was. It's a matter what happened.
But you've got some absolutely belter of a stories. I mean, some of the best. And I think, you know, when you were obviously kind of carving out your DJ career and ended up in New York and, you know, working on the door at the Lyceum Club and working at the Paradise Garage or attending there.
I mean, yeah, you know, my life, I was very fortunate that I was born when I was born, and I truly believe that. And that's why I'm really proud of my age, because if I was any younger, I wouldn't have done those amazing things. Mm. And I wouldn't have been living in a world where we didn't have social media and we had to get up off our asses and create a platform. It's a very creative time of the 80s and the 90s, because we didn't have it in our hand, and we couldn't pretend to be somewhere we weren't. And, you know, we kind of had to fight for a right and a voice. So I'm very fortunate to be of this age and still be here and still be relevant and still working and all the things that I do. But the stories, you know, They were amazing times. They were amazing times. And people sometimes go, oh, what was the best time of your life? And I'm like, it hasn't happened yet. Because it's like, there's so many yets to happen. Mm. I mean, I'm very fortunate to have gone to Paradise Garage and met the people I did and be with the people that I grew up with. You know,
is it true that your mate Richard, though, had to give some favours to the manager?
He's going to be my best man at my wedding. Aww. Richard, not the manager, not the guy
manager of the Paradise Garage.
No. Oh, he's long dead. But Richard Haberley, he's going to be one of my best men, and Boy George is the other best man, because you know they've been by my side all my life, and you know we've been through a hell of a lot of stuff, and it's kind of just testament to where we're at. But I'm very fortunate. Very fortunate. I'm blessed.
Well, the fact that you're even here for reading your story is a kind of a miracle, basically. And I'm very glad that you are. But can you maybe tell us a little bit about, the Paradise Garage? It's one of those places that is legendary in the kind of, music world.
The thing about nightclubs are they become legendary really easily because, a few people go there, get drunk, spread stories, tell everyone. And then suddenly, it's like the myth of Bergheim. Yeah. Oh, my God, it's so hard to get in. No, it's not. It's such the best club in the world. No, it's not. The music's so incredible. No, it's not. It's Bergheim, all right? It's a moment. But Garage was, when you went there, the last time I ever went, someone had their face shot off outside. Oh, yeah, literally on Prince. They got shot, on King Street. But the thing about it was that you went in and you went up this big, dark, ramp inside, which is the garage, basically. And it had these big old searchlights that went round on the floor as you went up. So it was a real moment to go in there and walk up the ramp and get to the top and then go in. And, they didn't sell alcohol. That was one of the amazing things of it. They had big bowls of fruit out the back behind the glass cubed walls. And they had a cinema and they had the dance floor. It was the tail end of disco, early house, and it just moved into that era of we were in acid house and we were moving into house music, and it was really such a magical thing because there was Larry would still play disco tunes. Larry would play whatever he wanted, and it was actually amazing, the feeling. And I loved Garage. I loved it so much. I the whole time that I lived in New York, I went every week. Well, I tried to. And then it stopped being every week for a while because there was trouble outside and whatever else went on. And then the last night of Garage was a pretty emotional thing. We were there for so many hours. It was incredible.
But, to have met Larry Levan and actually experienced that whole thing, was that a big influence on the kind of style of music that you played?
Well, Larry was a friend of mine. And when he moved to London before he passed, I saw an awful lot of him. He lived with his sister and, times were different for him. He wasn't the Larry Levan that the world looks up to and idolises now. We were going through what we went through with the AIDS crisis and the tail end of that. And a lot of people were sick and a lot of people kind of didn't know how to handle things. So they kind of shut down around people instead of helping them. It's not like it is today. With Larry, He was just a lovely person. He was a lovely person. And, he took the time to get to know me in New York, so I took the time to look after him and be with him in London.
And he wasn't well, or?
He wasn't well for a long time, no, towards the end. He was old.
Yeah, that's obviously a special time that, if you actually got to spend time with him in London. Obviously everyone knows him, as you said, as the legend, the icon. He's kind of one of those people that everybody name checks in the disco era. But, to have actually gotten to know him, I think, is something quite unique.
Oh, I blame that on George, as in Boy George, because he became really good friends with him at the beginning. Because everyone, at that point in time, George was the biggest star on the planet. So everyone wanted to know you because you knew George, or everyone, it was a meal ticket. A very good meal ticket. So I would find myself in the DJ box at studio Paradise Garage. I would find myself in all these amazing places, And then when I back to London after that, and that's before I started playing at Palladium. And I started playing at Palladium after that when I met Steve Rebell, who owned Studio 54. And I'd become resident. They would fly me over once a month to DJ at Palladium. And that came through Andy Warhol. It's kind of crazy, right?
That is definitely a crazy story.
Yeah, well, I met Andy. Andy came to London and I was running a club on a Tuesday night with a friend called Stephen Linnard, who's no longer with us. He just passed away a few weeks ago. And we were doing this club on a Tuesday night at the WAG Club, and it was called Total Fashion Victim. And Andy turned up that night, I think it's week three or week four. I just started DJing. I literally just got into it, or hardly into it, more out of it. But Andy turned up and came to the club. And basically that's how it started. And then they went back to New York and they were like, oh, my God, there's this amazing DJ. And you got to remember at that point in time, everyone in New York wanted to be in London. Mm. And the whole nylon thing was going on. And everyone in London was amazed by New York. Mm. Because, you know, the clubs were so good. And then Steve opened Palladium and I flew over for the opening of that. And then I started flying backwards and forwards, doing DJing there in the Mike Todd room upstairs, yeah.
Incredible. And you spent a bit of time with Diana Ross.
Yeah, Diana Ross, you know, all of these people. You know, it was all, you know, as I say, everyone wanted to be George's best friend at that point in time. And Diana Ross was another one. And George had gone and done this Motown thing, down in the Bronx, and Stevie Wonder, everyone was at it, and got to know Diana, and then they built up a little friendship, and we all went out one night to Paradise Garage, yeah, wow, with Diana Ross. I mean, how fucking mental is that, going to Paradise Garage with Diana Ross?
As you do. I mean, yeah, you've met some ridiculously big stars. I mean, obviously Michael Jackson's in there somewhere, which I heard was quite underwhelming.
Yeah, well, you know what? Whenever anyone came to London, they would always get me to do the after parties. And, you know, I still do that now. But, you know, it's like, so people would fly in and then the record company would be like, oh, we've got to get Fat Tony. And so it began. And so, I worked for Prince. I worked for Prince about 23 to 24 times, I think it was. We worked out the other night. Michael Jackson a few times, like three or four times. Very underwhelming, indeed. I mean, I wasn't, you know, what do you expect? Do you get what I mean? It was very... very shy and very, like, he kept himself to himself. It was a lot of yes people around him at that point in time. I've literally worked for so many people. But I still do today. You know, people always go on about, oh, the Michael Jacksons, all this and that, because they're no longer with us. And some of them, you know, with their checkered pasts. It is what it is, isn't it?
Mm. What, and, you know, what brought you to spend time in New York in the first place?
George was living there. And I went. I flew over on my 18th birthday. First of all, on Concorde for my birthday present, and just fell in love with it. Mm. Fell in love with the freedom of New York. You know, you got to remember in London at that point in time, everything shut at 2 a.m.
That's true.
We're at 3 a.m. You're at home in bed, or you're in Soho in illegal drinking clubs. Mm. You know. That was London. New York, on the other hand, the city that never slept, you could go all different places. There was like so many amazing venues and so many amazing clubs. And there was so much money involved in it. In London at that point, there was three streets with like four clubs on, which was called the West End, Soho. And that was kind of it. It never really went beyond that. You had illegal drinking clubs over in West London. You had illegal drinking clubs all over the place. But they were for different crowds. They were never like, you know, the fashion crowd or anything like that. You didn't really have that going on. And everyone wanted to be in New York because of the hours that it opened. And you had like incredible clubs like Save the Robots, which was on Avenue A, which opened all night. And then you had World. You had all these amazing venues, Area and The Saint, like, you know, Twilo. I mean, I could go on. You know, it was a really happening time. It was a really magical time before Mayor Giuliani came in and completely raped the city and shut everything down. You know, AIDS had a lot to do with that as well. The AIDS epidemic kind of cleansed everything. You know, all the good things went from that because of the fear around it. And I just think when Giuliani took over and started shutting everything down, New York changed, you know. I'm still in love with New York. Every time I go to New York, my love affair flares up. Mm. It's like herpes. It literally flares back up and I'm like, oh, I'm stuck with it for a few months. And I'm like, oh, let me get over it. And then, you know, I kind of forget about New York again until I go back.
And it flares up again.
Always. Every time. I literally think, oh my God, I just fucking love it here. You know, it's like Ibiza, you know. I'm here every year. And have been for many, many years. Mm. And my love affair with this island will never, ever go away. Mm. It just changes sometimes. Sometimes it's like any relationship. Mm. You know, there's irritable things about it. But those irritable things are the things that you kind of tend to... You have to have to make you realise how much you love the good things of it.
What are those irritants about Ibiza?
Just as the season progresses. You know, I don't do people. I fucking hate people.
I'm honoured.
I hate people en masse. I hate people at airports. I travel probably more than as most people. Mm. I'm like flying 3-4 times a week sometimes. Mm. And my carbon footprint is like, you know, bigger than Louboutin. I struggle with flying. I struggle with people. I struggle with just people in general. And as the island gets busier and busier, and the people kind of like take a nosedive in August, and it's kind of like, okay, I didn't really, you know, it's like suddenly BA becomes Ryanair, and everything suddenly becomes, you know, it's no longer Marks and Spencer's, it's suddenly Lidl. It's kind of scary. It scares me. So I kind of try to stay away as much as I can in those latter months, and like September, October is the time to be back.
Why do you struggle with people, and why do you do what you do if you struggle with people?
I have really bad ADHD, and you know, I've always had it. It's not a newly diagnosed thing like most people. You know, you've got to remember ADHD is suddenly the new pulled pork. Everyone's got it because of their behaviour. But you know, in my book, I state very early on when I was thrown out of school because I was unruly and I was unteachable because it was untreatable. No one knew what it was. Mm. And so therefore I was a problem child. Mm. And, you know, so a part of that, some days I'm really good with it. It's a 6 or a 5. Some days it can be a 12. And when it's a 12, I have this extrasensory thing where I can be somewhere and I tune into people right across the room chewing. I can hear it. I can hear them chewing. I can be in the lounge, and it's like. I always say it as a joke. Oh my god, I've got poor people grazing, because it's like it's like I can hear the clinking of cheap glasses. I can hear like the eating of crisps.
Is that an ADHD thing? I have it terribly. I didn't even know there was anything to do with it.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
Poor people grazing.
That's what I call it. Yeah. And it's like, you know, it's really bad when I'm tired or I put my body through a lot. You know, if I like the other week, it happened at Easter, and I'd done like 7 gigs, and it got to the 7th gig and I had zigzags in my eyes, and I got so ill, and I was in such a bad place I couldn't string a sentence together. I didn't know where I was going. I went all disorientated, and it brought on a migraine. And that with the extrasensory thing, all of it was just like, I had to go away for 4 days to the countryside just to bring myself back. Mm-hmm. But I'm dealing with it. I'm now on lion's mane, which seems to be really working. It does, believe it or not. It seems to
those
be
really, magic mushrooms.
You know, lion's mane is just like, it's really good for ADHD. It's really good for like overthinking things and clarity. Because I do need clarity. Some days I can really have bad brain fog.
It's very interesting, though, because actually you just brought it back to me that I did actually interview Boy George maybe 10 years ago here in Ibiza, and it was at Carl Cox's Sands Club that was in front of Ushuaia back in the day. And I remember him saying that he'd also been through recovery, basically, and actually sugar was his main issue, and he said it was worse than cocaine.
Well, I got George clean. I lived with him, and you know, I took him to his first meeting and lived with him for 4 years, the first 4 years of his recovery. And a lot went on in those 4 years. But life-changing. And, you know, he does what he does now, and he's not touching drugs again. And he's in a much different, much healthier place. And, you know, recovery is a many, 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 many fingered hand. Mm. There's so many different parts to it and so many different ways of doing it. You know, 12 people that are in who do it the AA way or the NA way will tell you there's only one way. I got clean the NA way. I'm 17 years sober and clean because I do AA and NA. But there are many other ways of getting clean and staying clean. Mm. Right? You know, it's about finding your own people, and it's about finding what works for you. Mm. Don't ever let someone else tell you how it works. Mm. Find out yourself. And, you know, so I never really look down my nose at when people, I hear people are, oh, so-and-so's now drinking. I'm like, okay, that's good for them if that's what they want to do. You know, for me, they've not gone out. They've just gone in a different direction. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, it does go wrong. But there's always the one, right? And it's, who are we to judge on someone else's recovery? If that's how they want to do their recovery and they're still functioning and they're still living their life to their best ability, then that, so be it.
But it seems you're like entire inner circle, pretty much, like Kate Moss and, you know, Boy George, and like a lot of people really are kind of, you know, changing their lifestyles. Really, there was this heyday of hedonism, but it seems like that's kind of changing.
Well, you know, we had the power to lead by example. And when we're in circles of whoever it may be, I can't speak for Kate. She'll speak for herself. You know, that's nothing to do with me. She's one of my best friends, but I don't involve myself in talking about her. But with everyone else around me, we do lead by example. You know, they see us having something. They see us fun. Like the amount of times I get asked, how do you do it? How do you go to clubs and how do you fly around doing your job that you do? How do you do it sober? And because I choose to. And I couldn't do it any other way, because it wouldn't work any other way. Everything I have in my life today is from recovery. I have freedom, I have self-respect, I have love. Right, those are the three biggest things. Everything else comes second, third, fourth, fifth, 28th, 200th down the list of what I have. Material things aren't important in that sense. Of course they're important, because we all love what we do, and I love shopping. You know, that's how I get high. You know, it's like going into a shop and buying something. And I can get it probably for nothing off most of my friends who are designers, but I still like to go and buy. And my way I look at it is like, that's my thing. But I don't buy on credit cards. I don't go beyond my means. I kind of relatively keep it in. Do you know what I mean? But that's my thing. And I just think that when it comes to vices, life, we all need little vices, just not the ones that kill us.
What's your little vices apart from shopping?
Sugar. Sugar's a good one. I mean, you know, dogs. I love dogs.
That's a pretty good one. That's not really a vice, is it?
It can be. Trust me, if you want everyone else's dog. You know, I would be happy with 60, 70 dogs. I really would.
Dogs, I'm sure Stavros might not be.
No, he wants a dog. But when we later on, we're going to get a big house and we can take in loads of rescues and maybe even open a rescue centre. I think that's the way forward for me, because there's, you know, it's unconditional love. And I've been sharing a lot of that in my life. And I think it's really important.
Do you think that's like the only way to get to where you are now?
Well,
be given unconditional love.
Yeah, I do. I truly believe. I think if anyone loves you and there's boundaries put on it, there's always got to be boundaries. But if there's buts on it, right, it's not love. You know, I put my mum through so much in my life. My mum's one of the most incredible people on this planet, because she never gave up loving me. And the love that she had, she always kept me alive. And that's unconditional love. You know, I dedicated my book to my at the beginning of the book, it said, this book is dedicated to my dog, Taylor, who was with me throughout. She passed away a month before the book came out. And she'd been with me for 16 years, right? For the last year of my using and the 15 years of my clean time. And she saw me at my worst and she saw me at my greatest. And I dedicated the book to her, and unconditional love, and to all the mothers of the world of addicts. Because, you know, we put our mothers through so much, but they're still there. And it's like, you know, and for a lot of people that don't have that, you know, it's a very sad thing. You know, I'm very blessed to have my mum. She's fucking like 86 now. Like, still like a 56-year-old.
And she never judged you all through that time?
No, she never judged me. She didn't like what I did. There was times, but she would always tell me. She still doesn't like some of the things I do now. And she'd still tell me. She'd be like, oh, why have you got that tattooed on your arm? Or why have you done this? And I'm like, oh, shut up, mum. But, you know, it's, yeah, no, she's, you know, I try to make her proud every day. I do. Because I put her through so much a long time ago now, but I put her through so much heartache, and I never want her to feel that way again.
No.
If I had the ability to make her happy, I'll do that.
Beautiful. I think, yeah, I mean, no mother is ever going to really, unless you've done something really dreadful. I think that, you know, she's obviously a very glamorous, very intelligent, very hard working. Obviously, your dad was a plumber and had fingers like bananas. I mean, I love that line in your book. It always makes me laugh.
They were like bananas. Trust me. They're like fucking massive bananas. Yeah.
But you had parents that, you know, were quite strict and really cared. And I think, you know, that's very, very important.
Yeah, I think that the fact that they were strict and they did what they did, and my dad was the way he was. You know, I spent 30 years of my life hating my father because I didn't get to know him. Mm. It was easier for me to hate him because I hated myself. Mm. It was easier for me to blame him than look at what I was doing. It was easier to hold on to the fact that he was an alcoholic and used to beat my mum up when I was 8. And 10, you know, for 2 years when he drank scotch. My dad hadn't had a drink for 30 years, and I never took the time to know. And I remember going to see him when I got clean and saying, Dad, you know, I'm really sorry for everything I've done. And at this point in time, I was 6 months clean, and I was like, you know, I'm here being the bigger man, making a... Do you know what I mean? And my dad went, why don't you fuck off and come back with your 6 years clean and you've done the work on yourself and you know what you're apologising for. And he was so right. Because it wasn't until I was 6 years that I actually realised, you know, that making amends isn't saying sorry. It's about change. To amend, to affix something is an amend. And, you know, there's certain things you do in your life that you could never fix, but you can fix them by not doing them again. And it's about change, you know. And my dad was right, you know. Luckily, I got to know him in his last year of his life properly through circumstance. And, you know, I was with him when he passed away, and I'm truly blessed that I was with him and I had that opportunity to be with him while, you know, before he died. Mm. I think it's a weird old thing, life. It really is. And, I, you know, it wasn't just by chance that I was there. These things happen for a reason.
Why were you there?
I'd had a court case and I'd been bowed down to my mum and dad's house a year clean and sober. And, you know, you find yourself in these most mental situations. And it was really, it was like a real test to test me. And so much amazing things came out, probably the darkest time in my life. And of course, you know, I won the court case. I was vindicated. They cleared it. You know, the person in question had lied in court and then admitted lying. And it was a drama and a half. And, you know, that if I hadn't have had that going on in my life at that point, I don't think I would have ever got the chance to be with my father again, because I would have been too busy sort of holding on to the past that never really happened. Mm. The way my version of the truth isn't necessarily the truth. Mm. Do you know what I mean? It's my truth of it. And it's not until you actually find out the truth and you think, oh my God, why did I think that? You know, to think bad of him served me a purpose and it served really well. Mm. You know.
Mm. The blame game.
The blame game. It's very good, you know. And without using all the crap anecdotes of the one finger pointing at them and four pointing back at you, it's so true. You know, it was easier for me to blame my father for everything than to blame myself.
And you say there was like many things that you need to affix to kind of get through or make amends. And like, what were, you know, some of the biggest things that you had to go back and fix?
Just the way I treated myself and the way I treated other people, because the way we treat it, if I feel good and I treat myself good, I'll treat everyone else around me good. If I'm having a bad day or I feel like shit, in the past I would project that onto other people. And, there were so many different things that you have to, like, change in your life. I started my writing the book and I said I have no regrets at the beginning of the book. And at the end of it, I started this book by saying I had no regret. I had so many regrets. And you know what, kind of just everyday purposes, you know, the way that I live my life now is an amends. The way I treat myself and I treat my dog and I treat my partner is an amends to past partners. I do things unconditionally, which is fucking remarkable, because I never did. There was always a condition on everything. And now, you know, I try to make everyone around me, believe it or not, feel good. Don't get me wrong, I can still be the biggest cunt that walked the earth. But, you know, I do it with class now. I do it in a different style.
Well, that's all right then.
Yeah. I'll be a liar, you know. For me, if you told me, right, like 20 years ago, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, that the minute you start telling the truth is the minute you'll find freedom, I would have laughed in your face. But, you know, freedom really does come from being honest. Totally honest. I don't have any skeletons. I have nothing hiding in my closet. It's all in that book. And I'm writing book two at the moment. And it's like, it's a totally different book. And it's going to be a totally different direction. But it's exactly the same thing. Truth's coming out in it. And just like, you know, I used to be tolerated, but I'm not anymore. Do you know what I mean? I'm accepted. There's a real difference. Acceptance and tolerance are two different things. I accept who I am.
You talked to Lily Allen in the podcast about sort of, you know, her music being her redemption, and I kind of really liked that. And I felt like, you know, what would have happened to you if you hadn't become a DJ?
I really couldn't tell you, because I've always been a DJ. It was never the plan. I never had a plan. I just wanted to go out and party. And DJing was a way to carry on partying. It was a way to earn money and a way that I could facilitate both. So I fell into it. It was like one of those jobs. I think that, you know, as my life's changing now, yet again, I'm now producing again. I'm doing a film. I'm doing, there's so many different things I'm doing. They're yet. Do you get what I mean? I think maybe acting would have been an option.
I'd like to see that.
Well, you know, I spent a whole life acting. Do you know what I mean? Should fucking add at least 6 Golden Globes and 4 Oscars by now.
No, I totally agree with you. I can see that happening, actually. I think you would have been a great actor. But it just intrigues me, because it's like, well, which came first, the chicken or the egg? I mean, did you sort of, you know, were you getting mashed because you were on the party scene and on the party circuit? Or, you know, was the DJing the thing that maybe dragged you further into that kind of salubrious den of inequity?
No, I, you know, clubbing was always my first love. Music was my first love as well. And I just think that those two things went hand in hand. And then, of course, as I said before, London used to end at 3 a.m. and then we'd go to after parties. But as London got later, so did I. You know, suddenly we got 6 o'clock licenses, and suddenly there were 24-hour clubs. And, you know, and I was always a part of that. You know, for me, the scene really was my life. I remember the first time I ever went to a nightclub, I just thought, I never want to leave. And I haven't, you know. It's like, you know, I've lived a fulfilled dream of a life on so many levels. And, you know, I don't know. Yeah, there was no plan B, because there was no plan A.
Well, I think the best plan is no plan quite frequently. Mm. The name of this actual place that we're sitting at, the Hub Studios, was actually Plan B, which I quite liked, actually. And it was a club once upon a time, many moons ago. I don't know if you ever made it.
I did.
Here.
Yeah, I did.
Did you?
Yeah, a long time ago. I didn't realise it was Plan B.
This is it. You're sitting in it.
It's mad, isn't it?
We are the Plan B right now, right here.
It's mad, isn't it?
So you're playing it Back to Mine this week, which is very exciting. Week.
I'm playing there 3 times this summer, actually. I'm doing Glastonbury for them as well. I'm doing Glastonbury, Back to Mine at Glastonbury, and then I'm doing Pikes again later in the year for him. The closing, I do believe, as well. So I'm doing the opening and the closing. Wow. Good at that, aren't I? I did it last year as well, the opening of Back to Mine for IMS with Eat Everything. Amazing. It was such a great night. And I couldn't get enough, so I'm back.
What is it that's special about the sort of Back to Mine nights?
You know, it's all different age groups, and I really love that. There's, you know, you've got gay guys, you've got it's straight, it's gay, it's what clubbing should be, right? You know, when we categorise things and we put things into boxes, they stay in boxes. I'm a firm believer that, you know, when we segregate anything, it suddenly becomes us and them. And with Back to Mine, it's us. It's all of us. It doesn't matter about your sexuality, your age, what you look like. I really truly, that's what this island has always been about. You know, it's not about, you know, telling half a bosser that they have to wear McQueen trainers still in 2024, even though the world's actually moved on 10 years ago. But, you know, that kind of category is not Ibiza. Like, you know, I have friends that come and, you know, like trans girls, and they walk down the street and they get shouted at. That's not Ibiza.
No.
Do you get what I'm saying to you? That was never the magic of this island. That wasn't the magic. Show. That was the other end of the spectrum. And I just think that with clubs like All Back to Mine, where it's not about, you know, what you're wearing and all of that stuff, people are there to have a good time. And I love that. No, it's got that old school magic.
Is that a Pikes thing or is that a Back to Mine thing?
I think it's a little bit of both. You know, the perfect club is a recipe, right? Anything is... when you go to a restaurant and you have the most amazing meal, it's not because of... someone's just throwing it on a plate. It's a recipe. You know, you walk away and you think, oh my God, that was the most incredible taste in your mouth. That's what Pikes and All Back to Mine give you. You know, there's very few places that you get that magic in this world. And when you do, it's kind of like, it's a good thing.
Have you got any good Ibiza memories from before maybe your recovery process? Is there any kind of like good stories?
Oh, I did one the other week actually about Alfredo, you know, Amnesia, when it had, before the roof went on and it was so small. Amnesia, I don't know if you know, was tiny.
No,
yeah, it wasn't big at all. It's not what it is now. It's not the bus shelter that it is now. It was very small. It had one dance floor there. It had like a balcony, a mezzanine, DJ box was there. It had a parachute, silk parachute in the middle. And then it had like little fountains, like water pits with the pyramid, mirrored pyramids in. And that was kind of it. That was it, you know. And it went on from there, you know, it got bigger and bigger. But, you know, DJing there the first time, and Alfredo hated me because I did his set. They swapped his set times around. And he thought I was like, you know, this English guy coming over to take his job. Because that's Jose and Sandrine, who owned it at the time, become really good friends of ours. So, of course, you know, the old cuckoo that I am always getting everywhere. And, yeah, you know, I used to love Privilege Coup. Coup was one of my favourite places in the world. First went there in 83, then went back in 86. Kind of mad.
What was that like in the 80s, Privilege and Coup?
Amazing. It was amazing. You know, no roof, dancing under the stars in the biggest club in the world. You know, with the fountain, in, like the water fucking shoot in the middle of the pool and that, which came out a little bit later. But, you know, the venue itself, Brasilio, who owned it, who does La Troya now and all of that, you know, at that point in time when they managed it, they had the Coca Loco bar, where they used to put MDMA in the Coca Loco, which sent everyone crazy at midnight. It was that was the magic of the island. You know, going to the Coca Loco bar and getting and knowing that you're going to get this Coca Loco drink that's got whatever else in it.
Did people know?
Yeah, of course they did. It became like the Bergheim myth. But the inn people knew what time to go to get Coca Loco, hence Coca Loco.
Is that how Where Circa Loco was born?
Yeah, of course it is. And, you know, the whole Loco thing was like you'd had this coconut drink and, and the rest was history. But, you know, I remember the first time I came in, the second time I came in 80, in like, I'm not sure what year it was. I came over to do with London With Love, from London With Love. No Sleep Till London, it was called, at Coup. And it's with a guy called Steve Strange that run London back then, and me and him flew over with all of these people from London, and we stayed in a hotel in Figueratis, we took over the whole hotel, and we did this fashion show, and it was for Boy London did a fashion show. Anyway, the first night we were here, I went out and didn't come back for 3 days. Ended up with this Spanish boy that couldn't speak English, and I couldn't speak Spanish, and he wore Jean Paul Gaultier, and so did I. That was the only thing we had in common. And he worked as the barman on the Coca Loco bar. And I stayed all summer with him. No money, no passport. I'd lost my passport, yeah. But that was the magic of the island, to come here and just be... And now I'm one of those people that go, what do you mean you're going to Ibiza with no money? What do you mean? This is, I did it all, like, you know.
What did you survive on?
Other people's misfortune. Yeah, no, he had a good job at Coca Loco Bar. Don't worry.
I'm sure he did.
Yeah, I was a kept woman for a year. No, it was great. It was really good. You know, there was lots of those magical times where I just kept coming back for every year.
Are there any kind of like inspirational sets that you can recall? Or, you know, obviously Alfredo was one of the kind of the godfathers of Ibiza, but like who did you see during the 80s here?
There were so many people, so many people. And then, of course, you know, when Manumission started and everything else started, you know, the IB for it changed so dramatically so quick. Mm-hmm. You know, because you used to go to Coo and there'd be like the Locomia, who had a shop in the old town. They used to wear these long pointed shoes with backcombed hair and fans, and they were like goths, like you would call goths now, and they run the island, like, to a certain extent. Like, they would be in the old town and they danced at Coo, and they were like the island. There were so many amazing people like Jesus and all of these amazing characters on the island that you would come here and you would see year after year. And DJ wise, you know, going to space in the early days was incredible. Going to see your mates play everywhere was just amazing. We did Boy George's 30th birthday out here at the opening of Amnesia before the roof went on. That was a pretty special night, you know.
Sounds like a few stories in there, Tony.
There's a lot of stories, you know. We don't have enough time for that.
No, sadly not, which is a shame. But I think, yeah, you've obviously kind of like lived a bit of a life in Ibiza that maybe none of us will ever, you know. I didn't get here for the very first time until sort of like the late 90s. So kind of feel like there's a whole era that like many of us kind of skipped, that you saw like a real different side to Ibiza.
Well, you know, the thing about it is it's very well documented, but it's very badly documented. Okay. So, you know, yet again, people, you know, always... When you bring drugs and alcohol into anything, everyone always thinks they're the first ones that's ever done it. Do you get what I mean? And with Ibiza, everyone invented Ibiza. Do you know, they all invented it. Oh, I was the first one that did this. Oh, you know, and I think that, you know, the mystical, magical island that everyone talks about. It's so great to be back on the island. It's like you don't really know the island. Do you get what I mean? In that sense, those characters that you would probably laugh at now when they walk down the street. Are the ones that made it okay for you to come to this island. They're the ones that paved the way for the magic of the island. It's not fucking Esvedra. Do you know what I mean? You know, it's a bird shit island. It's a rock with bird shit on. You know, that when people talk about the magic of the island, oh, have you been to Esvedra? Have you been here? You know, the old town. The little old cobbled streets of Ibiza Old Town, where all the gays used to go and the discos used to be. Amphora, Crisco, as you went up into the old town, was full of, you know, the locals lived there and they respected those clubs on their doorsteps. You know, and then as things got bigger and bigger and new clubs opened and it all changed, you know, that was the magic of the island. It really was, you know. Used to come here and it'd be like gays and Germans. Seriously.
Where's that magical little bolt hole of the kind of gay scene that you still go back to every year when you come?
It's very dispersed. There is no one place. I still love the old town. I still love walking down that old street with all the German gay bars and all of that. I still love that. And I still love watching tourists get ripped off for buying hash at the bottom of the hill. I think it's just one of the most magical things. Because we've all got to do it. We've all done it. We've all bought, oh, I'll get some grass and you end up with a bag of parsley, you know, that thing. But that's still going on today, you know, like 40 years later, they're still doing it. It's kind of mad. That's kind of mad in itself, right? But
a bag of parsley.
Yeah, like, you know, or a lump of rock, you know, it's like it's mad. But, you know, the thing about it is that's, you know, that street where Lola's and all that used to be is not what it used to be, but it's still got the memories, and that's enough for me.
Amazing. And lastly, like, you know, I mean, I read that one of the things that you want to do with your husband to be with Stavros is that you want to go to Qatar and you want to kind of
they wouldn't let us do it. So I'm very fortunate enough now to be I have my own page in the Evening Standard every week, which I'm very opinionated about life. And I'm up for a couple of awards for it, which is insane. I can't even string a sentence together, but I write a page each week.
ChatGPT?
Something like that. And and now I'm a Times travel writer. And I've been on safari to South Africa. Did last year, which is coming out next week, actually. It's coming out on the Sunday the 5th in the Sunday Times. The highs and lows, the highs and come downs of Ibiza. So I reviewed all the hotels last year on the island. And I probably won't have anywhere to stay.
Ever again.
Trust me. You know, I'm just honest. You know, I'm telling you what you're getting paid, what you're paying for. Bad service, bad attitude, awful rooms. I go in for the kill on all of it. Yeah. So, goodbye, Nobu. I'll never see you again. You know, the thing about it is just like, traveling, and we wanted to go to Qatar because I was so vocal about it in the World Cup, and I fell out with a lot of my friends over it, which we still aren't speaking now, but that's fine, that's life, isn't it? You know, if you're that petty. And
why did you fall out with them?
Because I didn't agree with what they were doing, and they didn't like the fact that I was vocal about it. You know, I wanted to go to Qatar to see it for myself. You know, I don't believe in saying I don't eat olives unless I've ever tried an olive. Do you know what I mean? Oh, smoking's disgusting. Well, have you ever smoked? No. Okay, how would you know it's disgusting? You know, I have to do things. You know, if you tell me not to touch a metal plate, a hot plate, I'll touch the hot plate. It's not until I burn myself that I realise I shouldn't have done it. And it's the same with Qatar. I really want to go there just to see for myself. I want to put my money where my mouth is. I want to go to places like that and say, okay, it's not all right for us to go there. It's not all right to treat people the way you treat people. You know, it's not only Qatar. There's a lot of other places in this world right now that are, you know, the world's in a terrible, terrible state. A terrible state on so many levels, you know, but we continue to plough on. Oh, it's bad weather this season. No, it's called climate change. Oh, the world's at war. Oh, yeah, it is at war, you know. I'm glad you've actually realised it's a war. Do you get what I mean? And it's like, there's so much going on in this world. And I just really, I'm not a one-man band of like a freedom fighter in any way or shape or form. But what I do know is I have morals, and I know what's wrong and right. It's taken a very long time to know what's wrong and right. And, you know, I have a platform and I want to use it. Don't get me wrong, I'm not trying to change the world. I'm not trying to be like, you know, from the rooftops, but in a little way, by doing little things like wanting to go to Qatar and seeing it firsthand is a big step for someone like me. And it all got green lit. The Qatari government were very up for me going, and then I threw a spanner in the works. I said, oh, hang on, what's their stand on HIV medication? Because I've been positive for over 30 years, undetectable for 23 of those years. I can't give anyone HIV, can't give anyone anything. You know, I'm probably more healthy than most people are on this planet, but that's because I look after myself, and, you know, and I have a responsibility to look after people around me. Mm-hmm. So for me to take medication, that will enable me not to do that. I now have an injection once every 3 months. Mm-hmm. That counteracts it. So that's the world we live in. It's moved on so much. They were like, oh, no, pulled the plug on it straight away, because people with HIV, it's illegal for them to enter the country in 2024. That is the world we live in. You know, they take away people's medication and put them in prison and basically put them on a death sentence for it. You know, this is what's going on. But, you know, of course, it's okay to go there. It's a great place to go and visit for a holiday. Fuck off. Do you know what I mean? Seriously. So be it. So if you don't want to speak to me because I don't like the fact that you promote Qatar, whoever you are, I'm saying no names, that's not my problem.
Well, I shall never fly Qatar Airways again. I always used to get that cheap flight to India, but that's it.
We were looking at doing our wedding at the Rosewood, and I found out it was Qatari owned, and I was like, no, I'm not doing that. They really wanted us to do it, and I just thought, no, that's not going to happen.
Did you ever, you know, when you first got diagnosed with this, did you ever dream of a day when it would just be so, like, blasé almost about the fact that, it, you know, it's even a thing, because everybody's, you know, you've experienced a lot of loss in your life? And
yeah, of course. I mean, you know, the sad thing is that it's a forgotten one. It's a forgotten one. And all the people that died of it are kind of forgotten. You know, they didn't die in vain. That, you know, they it's okay now. You know, we take PrEP now. We've come such a long way that we live in a world where no one should be diagnosed HIV positive. Yeah. But they still are. But, you know, it's such a different disease today. Mm. It's no longer the death sentence. It's no longer that. It's still, don't get me wrong, you know, by me talking about it now, being open, it's still has so much you know, what's the word I'm looking for? There's still so much hatred for it, anyone that's with it, or, you know, there's still, it's still, it has so much stigma attached to it. Do you get what I mean? If I have an injection, I can't transmit. Mm-hmm. I haven't been able to transmit for 23 years. Amazing. 23 years, you know, that's kind of mad. 2001, I was diagnosed. Mm-hmm. I had it for like a lot longer than that before that. And, you know, I nearly died of it. And I'm here today, healthier than I've ever been. Who would have thought that 21 years ago?
Well, it's a testament to obviously the life you've lived, but I think, yeah, the fact that that was even happening 30, 40 years ago, everybody, like, you know, passing away, like, so frequently in London, and just how devastating that was, actually, to read that part of your book.
Yeah, all around the world, we went through hell. And the thing about it is, you know, no one should go through that hell in 2024, when it's... You know, would you treat people that have got chicken pox in the same way? I don't think you would. Do you know what I mean? Let's face it. Look at, did we shun everyone with COVID? We did for a while because we didn't understand it. And then we realised what it was and the big old fiasco that went with it. You know, things, you know, it doesn't mean you shouldn't be allowed to travel the world. You don't own the world. Do you get what I mean? It's I didn't go out to catch that. It wasn't something I went to a shop and said, "Oh, I had that in three different colours, please." No, you know, it's a misfortune. It was never something that happened to me that I willed to happen. You know, it wasn't a lifestyle choice either. You know, even though people would like to think it was and call it a gay disease, more heterosexual people get diagnosed than any in this world right now than they do in LGBTQ, because we all take PrEP. Mm. They don't in the heterosexual world.
What is that?
It's a PrEP. It's a drug that you take, a tablet that you take, and it basically stops you from catching HIV.
Okay.
Yeah, and most gay men are on it. Lots of heterosexual women I know are on it. And it's, you know, if you're having unprotected sex, it's something you should take. You know, we've come a long way on so many levels. There's now a tablet that you take the day after you've had unprotected sex with anyone that stops you from catching STIs.
They should be selling that one in Ibiza.
Should be selling that one everywhere.
In San Antonio.
Do you get what I'm saying to you? It's crazy, right? It's amazing how far we come. But yet, on that front, but on the other front, we're still going backwards on so many levels. It's, you know.
Thank you, Tony. I think that draws us fairly neatly to a close. We're going to end on sex. I mean, why not?
Sex. What do you want to know about sex?
I don't know. What have you got to tell me about sex? I'm sure you could.
It's another 4-day podcast. Let's leave it there, yeah?
Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to seeing you at Back to Mine, and it's been a pleasure to have you here in the Hub Studios.
Thank you for having me.
Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. It's the Reset Rebel. Coming to you every day.